This is the Senate Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure, Tuesday, February 2nd, 1 p.m., Room 315, State Capitol Building. Today's agenda, Introduction to Proposed Criminal Code by Donald L. Paulette, Project Director. Senate Bill Number 40, Article 1, Preliminary.
We'll call a meeting to order. We have more than a quorum present. I'm going to call on Joe Smith of the District Attorneys Association to make the a statement that he wishes to make. Joe here?
We're in the door.
Joe, I just called your name, so you're in the hot seat right now.
Thank you very much. I had to climb the stairs, so I'm a little out of breath.
Sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm R.P. Joe Smith, District Attorney from Umatilla County. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association today. I have just a very, very brief statement. On behalf of the association, we want the committee to know that the association, as an association, is very approving and very much in favor of the commission report. Now, there will be individual district attorneys, undoubtedly. Oh, excuse me, I'm going to stop just a minute and breathe.
It's all right, go ahead.
That's something we all passed on.
Individual district attorneys who have particular problems that they see that they'll be contacting you about. But we want you to know that as far as the association is concerned, we are wholeheartedly in support of a broad, complete revision of the Oregon Criminal Code. We, as district attorneys, work with the antiquated code we now have every day. And we know well how badly changes are needed. The Oregon Criminal Code, when it was enacted over 100 years ago, was probably well ahead of its time. Perhaps because it was well ahead of its time, it took a little longer for us to decide that time had come when it was behind its time. It now is. The District Attorneys Association will be maintaining one member of the association, either a district attorney or a deputy district attorney, in Salem throughout the legislative session. And one of the primary purposes of this individual is going to be to assist in any way in research or technical assistance to this committee in the goal of revising the Oregon Criminal Code. There will probably be individual problems that the association may want individual attention to, but generally we think anything that you give us is bound to be better than what we have. And I'm sure I speak for most of the association as individuals, as well as the group as a whole, when we say we favor the proposed criminal code. We think that it's a very exciting proposal. We think that the general scheme of it is not only a great improvement, but offers great opportunity for improving the criminal law enforcement of Oregon. There are many advantages to it from the prosecutor's standpoint that we don't presently have. As I say, you will be hearing from individuals undoubtedly. We want to speak of this or that. But the individual who is here each week from the association, as a representative of the association, will want to assist in any way he can. And if the committee needs a piece of research done or needs some technical comment on how something would work from a prosecutor's standpoint, please feel free to call on us at any time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Anyone have
Mr. Chairman, just one question, Mr. Smith. I understand your testimony to mean, so that there's no misunderstanding, that the District Attorneys Association specifically approves this particular code that has been prepared by the Criminal Law Revision.
That's true, in its general outline.
Yes.
Reserving the right, obviously, to comment about specific
Certainly.
Problems that may arise. And it's fair to say there may be one particular area there will be specific comments on, but the basic package, yes.
Thank you.
Didn't you tell me that your headquarters, or all the headquarters of the representatives from your association, will be with in the state police office?
That's correct.
Okay, so at any time you can.
We're maintaining an office over there. Number is 378-3720. We can reach the messages.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very
much.
We've also asked Bob Stevens from Legislative Administration to explain the computer use as far as this particular bill is concerned. Bob, will you take the seat, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Stevens, Administrator for the Joint Committee on Legislative Administration. My right is Kit Schoenborn, who's the Data Processing Manager for our committee.
Would you be sure to speak up, sorry, Secretary?
One of these, the Joint Committee on Legislative Administration has among its assignments that of conducting a continuous study of possible applications of technological changes and improvements such as data processing and electronic equipment to improving legislative procedures and making recommendations in this area. Now, what has this to do with the criminal law revision? It really is this, that we would like to work with your committee to develop a project that we have started several months ago to do for your committee in a small way what we think might be done for the entire legislative process. We recognize, in looking at what other agencies have been doing in data processing, that they run into great difficulties, especially if you go into a project or an agency whole hog and do the entire agency's operations. In our approach to legislative data processing, what we plan to do was to take one small segment of the legislature's operations and see if the data processing system could be utilized successfully. Now, when I say data processing, I'm thinking of a system that says, take the entire group of Oregon statutes, the ORSs, place them into a computer, so that when anyone wants to search the statutes for particular information, we can ask the computer to return this information. We would hope that we could change any, we could take changes that occur in the statutes and incorporate that. In other words, any bills that are introduced that would change the statute, and you want to see what it looks like and in growth, we could do this very quickly through a computer. Now, this would mean considerable changes to the entire legislative process if this were done. The advantages would be considerable because these statute searches would be almost instantaneous. But we don't want to do this in a large way until we know what will happen by carrying out a smaller project. So this is the reason why we're here. Now, what we propose to do, and we worked for several months to get to this point, would be to place into the computer the proposed Oregon Criminal Code and any other bills that relate to the criminal statutes. And anytime you wish to change either the proposed code or the existing statutes or any bills, these changes would be entered and retrieved and reported to you. We would also propose to work out a system for reporting the status of any part of the code or the status of bills, similar to what you now have in your calendar, a daily calendar, except that we would propose to summarize the changes, whereas the present calendar summarize a bill as it is entered and does not summarize any of the amendments that might be made. We would like then to demonstrate several times, we hope, during the session, to members of the legislature what can be accomplished through the use of data processing, and find out for ourselves whether or not it would be worthwhile to continue into a larger, in a larger way for the entire bill drafting and statute retrieval system. Now, I try to give you a general a picture of what we're doing. You have two members of your committee who are on the Joint Clean Air Legislative Administration who are aware of our past work on this. And Mr. Schoenborn, who is our data processing manager, could answer any questions in detail if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still in a little bit of a fog as to what this will do. Could you give us an example related to the criminal code? You say that you can give us the status of the code. Well, we know the status of the code. You say that you can seek information and the computer will give you that information. Well, give us an example. What kind of information would you seek?
Well, one thing, if you want to know a subject, now let's take the subject of burglary, and I don't know the interior workings of the criminal statutes that well, but let's say there's a word that you want, that you have decided upon. You want to know what the existing statutes are on burglary, all of them. You can ask the computer to send you all the statutes on burglary so that you wouldn't have to go through and pick them out manually. Now, you could also ask, what does the proposed Oregon Code say about burglary? Or if you know that they're using a different term for the word burglary, you can ask what these say, where they are, and how, and then you can put them side by side and make comparisons. If you then decided to make some exchange between the two, in other words, you say, well, let's take this part of the code and amend the existing statute in such and such a way, what would that do to the existing statute and get it quickly a, what I suppose we could call an engrossed version, and would this also then change any other part of the statutes other than the one that I, specific one that I want to change, that it would automatically make any changes with regard to that specific subject, burglary or whatever it may be.
Well, who's going to do the programming? It sounds to me like I think there is some real problems to really place much reliance on this sort of thing. I don't know. How expensive are programmers, and do they have legal knowledge sufficient to do what you're saying should be done?
Well, Mr. Schoenborn here is working on this project full time. That's his job. Now, he has no legal background. He is a data processing man. We have thought about putting on an attorney on a part-time basis if it is necessary to summarize and to digest various measures. On the other hand, we have been working with Don Paulette, whom we believe would work very closely with Schoenborn, so that we have this legal background to work with.
Wait a minute, Senator Brown wants to ask a question.
Are you putting any of the case law into the computer?
You what?
Case law, is there any case law going into the computer?
I'm not sure.
At this time, no. It's a rather voluminous amount. However, it is a thing that is being considered by the state bar at this time.
We have been working with the state bar, who's very interested in this project, and has the same goals as we have in the overall for all the Oregon Revised Statutes. And our interest, and there is, since it is the same, we would like to work closely together so that we wouldn't be duplicating each other in the long run, and both doing the same thing at the same cost. So they are aware of what we're doing. Mr. Schoenborn is on one of their Oregon State Bar's committees that is looking into data processing for statute search and retrieval.
Mr. Chairman, Bob, as I understand, this is solely an experiment.
Yes, it is, sir.
Now, if you were to apply what you're just telling us to the entitle, to the entire statutes of the state of Oregon, I could see where it might be of some benefit. In fact, if you take the existing criminal law of Oregon and apply what you are talking about to those statutes, it might be demonstrative and prove something. But when you, I don't know how much, how beneficial this will be, because burglary, for example, is very well identified and indexed. It's all in one place. Any other topic is, as far as this code is concerned. But I take it that what you're trying to do is to determine whether or not your program for the future will work on a large scale by applying it to something that's very, very minute, namely the criminal code.
That's exactly right, sir. Yes, sir. And we're not sure yet, because we don't know how you intend to proceed. We're not sure of what use we can be to your committee with the proposed code. We do know that we have the statute already in the computer, and we have that document in the computer, but we don't know how, what the use will be made of the two of them until we see how your committee would intend to go.
Don't shuffle them like you do a deck of cards. We might come up really mixed up, this and the existing code.
Isn't it also true that this is the largest minute element that we have in this
That's right.
session? So this
it's
is why
a workable
this
unit to deal with, where rather than having some bills that that only touch upon certain subjects. And this is what the reason we propose to do it on this, on the criminal code.
Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exactly sure in my own mind where we are as a committee in reference to your proposal. And so preliminary to my question, I got to say that although I was working through legislative council and later through legislative fiscal committee with this question from the very beginning, the last 2 years I haven't kept up with what's happening in your committee or fiscal committee or council or even in the governor's office. But this whole question is part of the, I want to say gobbledygook, but it's something worse than that, the mess that everybody finds themselves in the computer field today. Whether the guy that sells you something doesn't know enough about it, and so you got to know more than he does, and you don't, so you both get the dirty end of the stick. And this brings me to the question of what, as far as the legislature itself is concerned. I'm familiar with what's going on in many other states in the area of instant retrieval of bill status. No state that I know of has a better system of calendars and index than we have in Oregon. We've had it for years. We've had it for 14 years that I know about, and I'm thinking ever since Sam Haley came in 1950. Is that right, Tony?
I know. Well, actually, if you ask me, yeah. I think the index to the Oregon Code is absolutely lousy.
Well, I think he's talking about our daily calendar.
You're right.
Now, these other states didn't have this type of thing. And so they went into the computer system as something new and different as far as even getting any information about these bills are concerned. Now, I won't say that you couldn't do just as well or better by using the electronic data system. But I know dang well it costs you a lot more. Ours cost plenty. But there's nothing cheap about what you're talking about. And so then it comes again, somebody asked about the language, the key words. How do you make this thing work? Now, I know that they know more about it now. Pennsylvania started it about 6-8 years ago. And I'm sure they know more now than they did 6 years ago. But I hope to gosh they know more about it 10 years from now than they do now. What I'm leading up to is that if, I don't know whether our committee has a decision here to make, maybe it's already been made, but if for me, I would delay the decision on going to this as long as I possibly could, because we're not hurting. And as is pointed out, as far as this is concerned, hopefully, the latest work and techniques and knowledge will be much better than what Judge Deedy brought from Missouri. And so we've got something better than what we had to work with, and so whatever advantages you bring to this, they aren't nearly as important to this as it would be to the existing code, it was pointed out. So my real question is, do we have a decision? Are you committed to this thing and you're going ahead with it anyhow?
Well, can I answer this in a couple of ways, Senator? One, I agree with you that our system of daily calendars and our bill printing is as fine as I've seen any place in this country, and I've reviewed about every other state. Other states who have gone into data processing have done it largely because they had no way of reporting the daily status of what is happening in their legislature, and they come up with a report in a computer printout that to me is almost unreadable. And this is great for a state that started with zero. Now, we have bills that have a high degree of quality in their printing. We have calendars that keep you informed, up to date, every day in an easily readable form of what the status is in every bill. And if we can't do something better than that, then there's no need for us to do anything in data processing. I believe that we should start at that point and build upward. So we're not proposing in anything that we do, we wouldn't propose to take a step backwards and give you computer printout information. Our biggest problem really is to take the information that we think we can generate and would make give you more information and better mixes of information you now have and turn it out to you in as easily readable a form as you now have. If we can't do that, we shouldn't be in business.
You're talking about calendars and the status of legislation. Yeah. I think I mentioned it before, but I repeat it now that you stated it over. I'm not saying you can't do it better, but I'll say the amount of improvement is going to be so expensive that to me it's going to be ridiculous.
Well, this we don't know yet, and this is the reason why, rather than jumping in and saying let's do the whole thing, we are now saying let's try it out in a small way and see what the cost is, and see what we can apply, if we can apply some knowledge of what we've gained to doing it in a larger way. And this is really the reason why we're here with this project, because we just don't want to fall into the trap of doing the whole thing all at once and finding it's costly and that we're not gaining anything. The other answer to your question is, as far as what decision do you have to make, I guess the committee could say you don't need our service. We don't need your services at this point. I would hope that you wouldn't, because I hope you would give us an opportunity to see what can be done and give us the chance to see whether or not we can do something.
If we said no, what would you do? I mean, would this man leave you, or would you work in some other area? Are you committed to starting in on this? That's why.
I think we're committed to starting in on it because we've already got a lot invested into it. Incidentally, it's not our own money. We've got a small federal grant to do this. It's a work, as I mentioned before, it's a workable unit. It's a sizable unit to work with. If you didn't want to do it with this committee, I think I would. I'm committed that far that I would look for some other branch or some other committee or some other part of the legislative process that I could experiment with.
This is your first choice, though.
That's right.
Oh, just one further question, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask the gentleman from Umatilla County. If you understand what they have in mind, would this aid in law enforcement in any way? I'm not talking about looking for information retrieval, because I think that's more expensive unless it's self-supporting. I'm against it. But
as I have understood it, and I don't want to throw cold water, as I understand what the gentleman is proposing to do with this bill, I have the same reservation that Senator Turi expressed, as it's really giving something you don't already have, because you're starting with a pretty homogeneous package when you're starting with the work of this committee. And unless, as time passes, you substantially depart from what is contained in the Green Book, then I don't think you're ever going to get into too much trouble of being able to locate things quickly. If it should turn out that you do substantially depart from the Commission's report, then I would think the sort of thing he's talking about would be very effective. As far as our using a retrieval system in Umatilla County in law enforcement, it would be very nice to have, and we don't anticipate having the money up in our county for a long time. I think what the gentleman is talking about is just for the legislative process at this time. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, frankly, since you've asked me, and it's really not my business, but I've listened, it seemed to me that what he's talking about would be of tremendous value in following the activities of a committee like the Ways and Means Committee that handles a vast number of bills. Still, it's one unit, but a lot of bills, and it's hard to keep track of what's happening to all those bills. But I think that this committee is pretty much going to be working only with one bill.
I think Senator Carson has a comment he'd like to
make. My comment would be that I agree with much of what Senator Hoyt has indicated, and that's why we're at this point, for the reasons Dick stated, that Mr. Stevens and I spent considerable time trying to cut out a part of data processing that would fit the Oregon legislature. I agree with Dick that we haven't found any better calendar, and that's why we've stayed away from the calendar, which is what most states get into right off the bat. But we stayed away from that. I agree with Senator Uturi on the standpoint of the perhaps the bad place to start with the criminal code, because it's pretty clean right now. But I think if we just look at the back of our bill books and start asking ourselves the questions on the bills that are coming in, what relationship, for instance, does Senate Bill 54 have to our new code?
We could answer that kind of question.
They can answer it, and it would take Don Paulette a considerable period of time. Now, if we get, we only have three, four bills here, but I suppose we'll be getting more bills. This is the kind of thing that the computer will do instantaneously. And I think that this is well worth it. We may decide that the 21st century is not for the Oregon legislature, and we'll stay 27th, whatever that means. But on the other hand, we may find it's workable and efficient and go. And I'm strongly urged that we allow them to use us as a guinea pig.
Mr. Chairman, I know the Senate doesn't mean to put him up, Mr. Paulette, but I bet you a dollar to a donut that you ask him any question about this in existing code, and it won't take him much longer. The time you feed it into the computer, he'll have the answer for you. He'll probably just by himself. I'm satisfied with that.
Well,
let's base this on some real sound thinking.
Well, that's perhaps true, but nevertheless, I'm inclined to think that, inclined to believe that we should permit him to go ahead on this thing. We may not derive a great deal of benefit, but the legislature as a whole, and for future sessions, certainly may. Now, if Don Paulette had had the benefit of what they're attempting to do as we were progressing through this substantive code, and he wanted a retrieval of all of the Oregon statutes that involve the crime of burglary or larceny, there being some 75 different types of larceny or theft or so on, it would have been of tremendous benefit and value. And certainly it will be less now for our immediate purposes, but I think that the thing that we should look to is the fact that this, they admittedly, is an experiment to see what can be done in the legislature. We're simply passing upon the question of whether or not will they be permitted to use this criminal code as a vehicle to gain this information, which hopefully will be of considerable benefit to the legislature. And I'd like to see them go ahead and see what they can do.
One final comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hoyt's brought this up. I agree with his comment. I don't mean to poor mouth Mr. Paulette, but I think it's interesting, if I understand the Senator correctly, that he's willing to let the whole criminal code rest on the ability of one man to be around, and I hope the longevity of Mr. Paulette continues, but I think that's a pretty shaky basis for for any group.
Well, just my own comment on this is that I thought the die was already cast, and I certainly hope so. And we had Mr. Stevens up here just to explain what was going to happen, and hopefully we could get some help maybe later on. And as far as I'm concerned, they're going to go ahead with it, and I'm not even going to bring it up for a vote, because it's my understanding it has progressed to that extent. So we certainly thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any time that any member of the committee would like to discuss this project in more detail, I'd be happy to talk with them. Mr. Schoenberg, we're both down in room 8, and we're always open.
Thank you for coming up.
One thing. Bob, why don't you reduce this to complete detailed writing so that every member of the legislature will know what's going on?
Very good.
I think it's a good idea. Before calling Don up here, I want to acknowledge the presence of Representative Stoltz, who's here from the House Judiciary Committee, and we welcome you.
Thank you, Jim.
And I also want the clerk to notice the presence of everyone. I didn't take a roll, I should have thought. Good. Don, you want to come up to the seat now?
Mr. Chairman, could I?
You can make
talking,
anything
I don't
you want.
Mean
That's all right.
To, but I think it should be made clear to Bob and to all the House members that they certainly are welcome to participate in our discussion to the full extent as though this were your own committee. And that's the way you would want them to do it.
We have made contact with the chairman of the House Judiciary, and they're going to have a subcommittee meeting with us
on
all the meetings so that we can cut down the repetition as this business one gets over on the other side.
So hopefully this will be of some help to us when we get to it, and perhaps we can resolve it all here.
And please be ready to ask questions at any time, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Don?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Pallad. I'm Project Director for the Criminal Law Revision Commission. And today, I wanted to give you background information about the commission, what it is, why it is, what we've been doing and what we've been attempting to do. And I realize that some members of this committee are intimately familiar with the work of the commission, but on the other hand, some of you are not. So I hope that those of you who have been working on this over the past 3 years will bear with me as we get through some of the background information so that we can start with the proposed criminal code with as thorough an understanding as to the reasons behind it as we possibly can have. Now, first of all, I'd like to advise you, if those of you who are here don't already know this, that the Criminal Law Revision Commission was created in 1967 by the legislature by Chapter 573 of Oregon Laws of 1967. And the commission was directed to prepare a revision of the criminal laws of this state, including but not limited to necessary substantive and topical revisions of the law of crime and criminal procedure, sentencing, parole and probation of offenders, and treatment of habitual criminals, and to submit a preliminary report and recommendations to the 55th Legislative Assembly by January of 1969. And we did submit such a preliminary report to the last session of the legislature, at which time we advised the legislature pretty much of the policy considerations and decisions that had been before the commission. And although at that time our drafting and research was barely underway, we had a good idea of where we were going, and we tried to project at that point and give the legislature an idea of what we were going to do. And we were also directed by the Enabling Act to submit our final report and revision to the 56th Legislative Assembly. And that we have done with the proposed criminal code, which was distributed in August of 1970 to all members and prospective members of this session of the legislature. This proposal, the final draft and report, is substantially the same as Senate Bill 40, which you have before you, although the final draft and report did not contain all of the housekeeping amendments that you find in your bill. But all of the substance of the proposed criminal code of 1971 are in both of these documents. Now, who served on the commission? Well, the membership of the commission was fixed at 13 by the act, and it provided for membership as follows. An active member of the Oregon State Bar, who was to be designated by the Board of Governors of the Bar. A judge of a court of this state, appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. A district attorney, appointed by the governor. Three senators, appointed by the president of the Senate. Four representatives, appointed by the Speaker of the House. The Attorney General. Two public members, one appointed by the President of the Senate and one by the Speaker of the House. And those appointments were made. The commission held its organizational meeting in August 24 of 1967. At that time, Senator Uturi was elected chairman and has served continuously in that capacity with the commission since that time. Former Representative Dale Harlan of Milwaukee served as vice chairman in 1967 and 68. At which time, in January of 1969, Senator Burns of Multnomah County replaced him as vice chairman. Now, other members of the commission have included, and first of all, I'll tell you who the current members are, or who the members were at the time this final draft and report was published. Senator Jernstad of Hood River was a member. Wallace Carson Jr., was serving as one of the House members. Representative David Frost of Hillsborough, Representative Carl Haas of Portland, Representative Tom Young of Baker, Attorney General Lee Johnson, Circuit Court Judge James Burns of Multnomah County, Benton County District Attorney Frank Knight of Corvallis, Multnomah County Commissioner Don Clark, Robert Chandler, editor of the Bend Bulletin, and Bruce Spaulding, attorney at law in Portland. Other members who have served at one time or another on the commission include Senator George Ivers of Milwaukee, Senator Berkeley Lynn of Portland, Senator Thomas Mahoney of Portland, former Representative Ed Elder of Eugene, Representative Douglas Graham of Portland, former Representative James Redden of Medford, and former Attorney General Robert Y. Thornton. Now, the proposed criminal code, Senate Bill 40, which you will be examining in detail in the weeks ahead, will present each of you with many tough issues that will undoubtedly call for hard decisions. These will be the same kinds of hard decisions that the Commission faced over the last 3 years in its deliberations. Now, the Commission could have submitted a far different type of proposal to the legislature. It could have taken the safe, easy route and avoided suggesting substantive changes at all. The Commission could have done merely a topical revision and a rewrite of our existing law. But instead, it chose to attempt a meaningful restructuring of our entire criminal code. Senate Bill 40 embodies many of the reforms recommended by such highly respected groups as the American Law Institute, which formulated the model penal code after 10 years of extensive work by some of the finest legal scholars in the country, the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice, and the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. As Edmund G. Brown, chairman of the National Commission on Reform of the Federal Criminal Laws, recently stated when he was referring to the proposed new federal criminal code, "If the criminal laws are to be respected, they must be respectable." Now, much has been said and written over the past 3 years about the, quote, controversial, unquote, nature of the proposed code. But I submit, and I think you'll find in the weeks ahead as you examine the existing law and examine the proposals that are before you from the Criminal Law Revision Commission, that many of the present statutes we have in our existing criminal code are tolerable to society now only because they are not enforced. The Commission has taken the viewpoint that the criminal code should say what it means as precisely as possible and mean what it says, and get rid of the nonsensical crimes we have on the books that everyone laughs about, everyone knows are there, but never enforced. Now, one of the controversial areas that we, at least we've been told is controversial, involves obscenity. Now, in February of last year, February of 1970, the Criminal Law Revision Commission, after carefully examining our existing obscenity statute, ORS 167151, and the extensive body of U.S. Supreme Court cases, decided that this statute should be replaced. It was believed by the majority of the members of the commission that the statute was too broad to be enforceable and that the state should try to concentrate on areas that could be enforced, such as the protection of minors who are being victimized by smut peddlers, and also protection of the public at large from offensive displays of obscenity. This was in February of 1970. In November of 1970, 9 months later, the U.S. District Court for Oregon declared the statute unconstitutional on its face in the case of Hayes versus Van Humisen. So the fact of the matter is, despite the outcries to the contrary, is that we now have no law in Oregon to control obscenity at the present time. Now, in the area of gambling offenses, for example, another so-called controversial area, the Commission recommends that the criminal laws of this state focus on the professional, exploitative type of conduct and not try to prohibit the Wednesday night poker game. A literal reading of our statutes, and I'm sure any district attorney in the state will tell you the same thing, a literal reading of our statutes makes such games illegal, against the law and a violation of a criminal statute. We all know that such conduct goes on, and I submit that a district attorney who attempted to enforce a statute such as that to its letter would find himself in deep trouble in his county. Only a week or so ago, the Multnomah County Grand Jury, as part of its investigation into gambling in that county, issued a report recommending the enactment of the proposals submitted by the Criminal Law Revision Commission in this area. Several cities in the state already have enacted loitering and disorderly conduct statutes patterned after the commission's drafts. Our final draft and report has been cited with approval by the Oregon Court of Appeals. I have discussed this report at great length with Chief Justice Schwab. As a matter of fact, I talked with Judge Schwab this morning and was expressly authorized by him to advise this committee that each time the Court of Appeals has been faced with vague or conflicting provisions in existing law, he has referred to the proposed criminal code, and in each instance found that the problem was resolved, in his words, very well by the draft of the commission. The proposal, as you've been told by Mr. Smith, is supported by the Oregon District Attorneys Association. It was approved by the Oregon State Bar Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure, and was also approved by the Oregon State Bar as a whole at its annual meeting last year in Eugene. It has been publicly endorsed by the administrator of the Oregon Corrections Division. Now, the major goal of the commission during the past 3 years has been to restate and redefine Oregon's substantive criminal code. Specific objectives we've had encompassed within that goal were to eliminate obsolete language from the code, eliminate inconsistent penalties, eliminate archaic provisions of law which appear in this day and age to be neither necessary nor desirable in our present society. The so-called crimes without victims, trying to resolve the dilemma between immorality and criminality, which are not necessarily identical concepts, and to attempt to weed out from the criminal code the over-criminalization of conduct which appears not only in the Oregon Code but in the codes of most states in the Union. Another goal that we've had was to rearrange the substantive provisions of law in an orderly and logical grouping of the subject matter. Another goal was to eliminate overlap and duplication of substantive provisions. And finally, to create a simplified and workable body of criminal laws. Now, the results of these efforts can be illustrated by comparing the number of existing statutory sections in a given area with the number proposed in Senate Bill 40. For example, in the area of assault, the number of existing statutes on the books is 15. The number of sections in the proposed bill are 5. In the area of forgery, there are 32 existing statutes involving forgery. The proposed code contains 11. In the area of arson and criminal mischief, there are 40 existing statutes. Senate Bill 40 contains 7. In the area of theft and related offenses, such as obtaining property under false pretenses and embezzlement, there are 75 existing sections on the books. Proposed code contains 14. Now, this is just to give you a very quick view of the objectives and what the commission has attempted to do over the last 3 years. I think I would be remiss if I did not bring all of you up to date on how the commission went about its project and the methodology that we employed. The commission came into being in the middle of the year 1967. The 6 months of that year were devoted to fact gathering and planning by the commission, coordination with other states, contacting states such as New York, California, Michigan, Illinois, Connecticut, and a host of others that were engaged in at some stage of criminal code revision. In January of 1968, the project director was retained. Revision and adopting subcommittees were set up. We set up 3 of them, and research and drafting assignments were made to each subcommittee. The commission at that time decided to begin with the revision of the substantive criminal laws and to defer work on the procedural area until that was completed. Now, there were 3 basic reasons for this decision by the commission. Number one, there seemed to be a more pressing need for modernization of the substantive statutes, many of which date back to Deedy's Code of 1864. 2, the problems of criminal procedure are of such magnitude and are so unsettled from one case to the next, that they should be dealt with separately. And three, and this was extremely persuasive to the commission, the availability of the Model Penal Code, which was published in 1962, and the recent revisions of states like New York, Michigan, and Illinois, provided us with a ready and inexpensive source of research and drafting information. Implicit in this decision by the commission was the general belief of the members that a complete and comprehensive revision, rather than a mere rewrite of the criminal code, was needed. The commission then, after consulting with the other states and examining its own objectives, decided to submit no bills for enactment in 1969. However, as I did note, we submitted a preliminary report to the 55th Legislative Assembly. We decided to present our completed substantive revision as a single unit in 1971. Now, this was not that we wanted to present the legislature with a take-it-or-leave-it package, but we felt that this was consistent with the overall goal of the commission, and that was to have a comprehensive, consistent, interrelated body of criminal statutes, and the belief that because the new code was intended to be an independent, interrelated structure, that enactment of only part of it on a piecemeal basis would lead us right back to some of the very problems that are plaguing us now in our criminal code. Now, the research and drafting that was done by the commission consisted of an examination and analysis of the existing Oregon statutory and case law in every area that we examined. Comparison with the Model Penal Code, the New York Revised Criminal Law, the Michigan Revised Criminal Code, the Illinois Criminal Code, Connecticut, California, and several others. After this comparison and research and examination of our existing laws was done, the draftsman, and I should advise you that the drafting has been done by the project director, by other members of the staff, also by Professor George Plant, University of Oregon. And each draftsman, as he got into a given area of law, would examine each of these areas that I've mentioned, prepare a preliminary draft with extensive commentary for the use of one of the subcommittees. Now, the draft set forth the changes that appear to be desirable, or at least changes that should be explored or examined by the commission as a result of the research, while the commentary laid the groundwork for the policy discussions, both in the subcommittee and in the full commission as a whole. Each preliminary draft then was revised and amended as often as necessary, sometimes five or six times by the subcommittee, to strive for clarity and consistency, and also to get as much done in the area of the nuts and bolts work as we possibly could in subcommittee, so that the commission then basically could concentrate on the important policy questions. Once a draft was approved by the subcommittee, it was then channeled to the full commission for further examination and discussion. After receiving tentative approval by the commission, the draft then was reproduced in sufficient quantities for distribution to the various judges' associations, the district attorney's association, and law enforcement associations throughout the state for their appraisal and feedback to the commission. The final step in the drafting of the specific crimes, and most of the proposed code consists of specific crimes, was to put together the penalty sections. Now, we left this as a final step. We had a special grading and sentencing subcommittee set up, consisting of the chairman of the commission, the three subcommittee chairmen, and the attorney general. And each crime then that had been approved in substance by the commission was gone through again thoroughly by the subcommittee, and each crime graded into one of the basic crimes that was established by the grading and sentencing provisions that were applied to the whole code. This drafting technique was intended to, and hopefully did result in uniformity of classification of each specific offense, not only with respect to that crime, but in its relation to the other offenses that are proposed by the code. Consequently, we hope that we have achieved a consistency of penalties based on the relative gravity of each crime. As far as the amount of work the Commission did, we held over the past 3 years 57 subcommittee meetings and 21 meetings of the entire Commission. Now, as far as the structure of Senate Bill 40 is concerned, it consists of 33 articles and 433 sections. The first 32 articles, consisting of 288 sections, comprise the Oregon Criminal Code of 1971. The proposal, Senate Bill 40, does not contain procedural provisions, with a few minor exceptions and two very notable exceptions, one in the area of criminal responsibility, dealing with the so-called insanity defense, contains very detailed and extensive procedural sections relating to commitment and release of defendants acquitted because of mental disease or defect. Article 27, dealing with offenses against privacy of communications, sets forth many specific provisions relating to the issuance and use of eavesdropping and wiretapping warrants. The proposed criminal code is divided into two major parts. Part one, dealing with general provisions that apply throughout the code, and part two, the specific offenses. Part one is made up of the first nine articles in Senate Bill 40. Article one, dealing with preliminary provisions, the objectives of the code, general definitions and such. Article two sets forth the general principles of criminal liability, what kind of conduct is necessary before one would be guilty of a crime. Article 3 deals with parties to crime, accomplices, that type of thing. Article 4 deals with the justification, the use of force in defense of property or persons. Article 5 deals with criminal responsibility, the mental disease or defect situation. Article 6 deals with inchoate crimes, attempts, solicitation, and conspiracy. Article 7 sets forth the different classes of offenses, and I'd like to just touch upon that a little more detail. This is the area of the code in which we set out the kinds and grades of crimes that would apply throughout the code. We provide for three major types of felonies, class A, B, and C, and three major types of misdemeanors, class A, B, and C, and we provide a range of penalties for each of these classes. And then in turn, when we get to a specific crime, such as burglary or theft or arson, rather than setting out in that particular section a specific kind of penalty for that individual crime, we merely grade that crime as to whether it's a Class A felony, Class B felony, or whatever it happens to be. And then the sentencing court, when it gets to that crime, needs only to look at what the range of penalties for that particular class of offense is. Article 8 deals with authorized disposition of offenders and is tied in very closely with Article 7 and also Article 9, which sets forth the different sentencing options that would be open to the trial court. Now, Part 2 is comprised of the next 23 articles. Article 10 deals with criminal homicide, 11 assault and related offenses, 12 kidnapping and related offenses, 13 sexual offenses, Article 14, theft and related offenses, 15, burglary and criminal trespass, 16, arson, criminal mischief and related offenses, 17, robbery, 18, forgery and related offenses, 19, business and commercial offenses, Article 20, offenses against the family, Article 21, bribery and corrupt influence, 22, perjury and related offenses, 23, escape and related offenses, 24, obstructing governmental administration, Article 25, abuse of public office, 26, riot, disorderly conduct and related offenses, 27, offenses against privacy of communications, 28, prostitution and related offenses, 29, obscenity and related offenses, 30, deals with gambling offenses, 31, offenses involving narcotics and dangerous drug, which proposes to bring those offenses that are now located in chapters 474 and 475 and incorporate them as part of the basic criminal code. Then Article 32 deals with a few miscellaneous offenses that did not seem to fit logically in any of the other categories that I've outlined for you. Sections 308 to 430 of Senate Bill 40 are housekeeping amendments intended to bring existing statutes that are located and would continue to be located outside of the basic criminal code to make the necessary amendments in language or reference to existing statutes that would be repealed to make them conform to the proposed changes in the basic code itself. Senate Bill 40 amends 123 existing statutes. 467 statutes would be repealed, 340 of which are crimes. Seven of these would be transferred outside of the basic criminal code to regulatory chapters, and the others would be replaced by new provisions, except in those cases where the commission believed that those particular crimes were obsolete and should not be replaced. The new code would contain 152 specific offenses, including the inchoate crimes of attempt, solicitation, and conspiracy. 136 sections deal with the general provisions, definitions, defenses, and sentencing provisions, as I've indicated before. Now, I think, particularly in view I think there's been some mistaken belief that the proposed criminal code, Senate Bill 40, is a permissive code. And I submit to you that as you examine it in detail, that you will find that it is not a permissive code. It is a realistic code. We feel that, and I say we, I think I'm speaking for the majority of the commission, that law enforcement in the state of Oregon would be enhanced by enactment of Senate Bill 40. For one thing, the code takes a realistic view and look at question of legal moralism, and it attempts to draw realistic distinctions between what is immoral and what is criminal. Second, the code is more concerned with crimes that seriously threaten life or property of the community. And by remedying the problem of over-criminalization of the statutes, I think we can free the law enforcement agencies of this state to concentrate the areas where the public does need protection. The question of affirmative defenses, I think this will enhance law enforcement in this state. In many cases where we feel that it would be unjust or unfair to expect the state to disprove certain aspects of certain type of conduct, we have characterized these things as affirmative defenses. And in those cases where there are defenses set out, we clearly indicate whether it's a plain defense or an affirmative defense. The affirmative defense places the burden on the defendant to establish the defense by a preponderance of the evidence. The proposed criminal code prohibits the use of physical force in any circumstances to resist an arrest. The code contains much broader definitions of attempts, so that activity that under existing law is considered as mere preparation and cannot be punished as a crime or an attempt would, under our definition of an attempt, be considered a substantial step towards the commission of the crime and constitute an attempt. I submit this should allow law enforcement to move earlier in the planning stages of any type of criminal activity. The code contains specific sections dealing with dangerous offenders. Now, these sections would permit enhanced penalties for certain crimes that would otherwise be punishable as by imprisonment for, say, 20 or 10 or 5 years, depending on that particular classification of the felony. It would permit the code, under specific legislative direction and guidelines, and I might add that these sections are based on recommendations by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, the Advisory Council of Judges, and its Model Sentencing Act. These would permit enhanced penalties up to 30 years for certain types of dangerous offenders, even on first conviction. The commitment and release provisions in the responsibility defense, the insanity defense, would be much stronger. They would require, for example, that once a defendant has been committed by a court following a successful defense of mental disease or defect, that if the court determined that this defendant should be committed to the Oregon State Hospital or some other suitable facility for treatment, that that same court would have to make the determination, which would be a legal judicial decision, to release that defendant. Administrative release that abides under existing law would no longer exist under these proposed Senate Bill 40. We submit this will offer greater protection for society and bring the matter back to the court, back to the community where the original determination was made to commit the defendant in the first place. The proposed code contains a consolidation of theft offenses, liberalized provisions relating to pleading and proof on the part of the state, and the elimination of the technical distinctions between all the different kinds of theft crimes. Possession of burglar tools is made a substantive crime for the first time. We propose stronger provisions in the area of hindering prosecution and compounding of felonies. We have improved, clear, and we submit constitutional sections regarding the crimes of riot and unlawful assembly. The bill contains provisions for limited and legal use of wiretapping and eavesdropping that conform to the Omnibus Crime Control Bill of 1968, Title III of the federal law, which I might add the existing Oregon statute violates.
Which violates which? Federal law violates
ours? Yes, no, ours violates federal law, Title III. The bill contains substantive provisions covering damage by explosives, and generally an overall simpler format, a body of laws that are clear and understandable. The bill contains stronger robbery provisions, better protection against use of force and attempts to commit a taking of property by force, even though no property is actually taken, would constitute a robbery under our proposal. Also, the robbery provisions covers threats against third persons and property outside the immediate control of the victim, an area that's very confused right now. The proposal eliminates the technical distinctions between no-account checks and the non-sufficient funds checks. The proposal prohibits soliciting a prostitute. The proposal contains extensive definitions relating to the use of force in defense of persons or property. The provision that we've submitted contains stronger laws in the area of the seven major offense groups, where according each year to the state police reports, there are statistics that are compiled annually, the majority of serious crime in Oregon is committed. Now, this seven major offense group includes murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, grand larceny, and auto theft. In each of these areas, you'll find stronger provisions in Senate Bill 40. Senate Bill 40 contains a degree format consisting in many instances of two or three degrees of a specific crime. The feeling here is that they clearly would show to a prosecutor or a defense attorney or a judge the lesser included crimes are in any given crime, and also would facilitate plea bargaining and attempts to expedite the handling of criminal cases through the courts. I think you might be interested, and then I'll stop and try to respond to any questions, Mr. Chairman. With respect to this final draft and report, you might be interested to know that to this date, over 4,200 copies of this report have been distributed throughout the state of Oregon. This includes a copy to every active member of the state bar in the state, every Supreme Court judge, justice, Court of Appeals judge, circuit judge, district judge, and every justice of the peace. And as I indicated earlier, every member and candidate for the legislature received a copy, every sheriff's office and police department. I have some other comments with respect to methodology pretty much about the legislative history of this proposal and how we plan to retain and preserve the history and background of the deliberations of the commission. But recognizing that you've been listening for quite a while to me, I'll stop and let you have an opportunity to ask me any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
Don, do you want to touch upon the part that commentaries plays in the Green Book? I think that might be really interesting.
Yes, I'd be happy to, Senator Uturi. What we've attempted to do with each area and with each section for that matter, we've attempted to to place in this final draft report extensive commentary, which first of all summarizes what the proposal does. Secondly, it shows the source of the proposal, whether it's based, for example, on the Model Penal Code or the New York Code or Michigan or Illinois, perhaps a combination of elements of each, or maybe it's just a restatement of some existing Oregon statute. And then most importantly, I think, we set out the statutory and case law that we're operating under at the present time and indicate what effect the proposal would have on this existing body of law, whether it's is a statute or case law. For example, in two instances, we are codifying case law. The defense of duress and the defense of entrapment, for example, exist under our present law by case law, common law, but there are no statutes on it. We've attempted to clarify these two areas and codify them. And I might mention that this commentary, the basic purpose of it is to provide a clear statement of the legislative history and the background that went into the discussions, and because we recognize that although we've made a diligent attempt to answer as many questions as possible, there are certain questions that are unanswerable except on a case-by-case basis. But we've attempted at the same time to provide persons who would be using this code in the future, particularly the courts and the appellate courts, as much of a statement of legislative history as we can in our commentary. Naturally, we were limited. It's obviously quite a bulky document the way it is. But at the same time, we've retained not only all of the minutes of every meeting, subcommittee or commission meeting, we have complete minutes on tape. We have what we call a recap sheet for every article in the code, which sets out in chronological order the complete legislative history as far as the commission was concerned, what subcommittee it started in, what days the meetings were held on, what minutes those would be, and refers cross-references to the particular tape on file, and also the members of the committee. What action was taken by the subcommittee, and what action ultimately was taken by the commission. Now, ultimately, when the commission concludes its work, all of this material then would go to the archives, and we feel that when the commission has finally finished its job, that this will be the best documented record of showing the legislative history of this type of project that we've ever had in the state. Basic reason was to try to answer as many questions in the commentary as we could, where it was not, or where it was apparent that we couldn't set it out in the statute.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to get ahead of our program here, but about 12 minutes ago, you made reference to a part of the new code that said certain types of cases the defendant had the responsibility of proving himself innocent, and I think that's what you said. And then in other cases there was, and I don't know about what you're talking about to even ask the question, but I'd like to know, if you know what I'm talking about, where in this bill and where in the commentary will I find that particular reference?
Well, for example, first let me answer the question about the defendant having to prove himself innocent. Of course, any time an individual is charged with a crime, the burden remains on the state to establish the guilt of the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt. We could not change that, even if we wanted to, and nobody did. But at the same time, there are certain types of defenses that can be raised to a criminal charge. For example, under existing law, the insanity defense is the one instance under existing law where the burden is set on the defendant to establish this defense by a preponderance of the evidence. We would continue that same allocation of the burden under our proposed code. The only thing is we call it an affirmative defense and then in turn define what an affirmative defense is. We set out in section 4 of the bill the definition of a defense and affirmative defense. Then each time you come to a statute where a defense is provided for, then we would indicate that that's a defense or an affirmative defense. Now, for example, in the obscenity area, we have provided for certain types of defenses, and we indicate whether they're straight defenses or affirmative defenses. In the area of sex offenses, there are certain defenses that are set forth. And I couldn't tell you exactly what individual section each one of these is located in. It would be as you go through the index and the table of contents of the bill, each place where there is a defense, that's noted in the table of contents. And then as you turn to that section, it would inform you as to whether it was a plain defense, in which the burden would remain on the state to disprove that defense once it was raised, or whether it's an affirmative defense, in which case the burden would be on the defendant to not only raise the defense, but establish it.
Is there a place in this book where this general discussion is taking place?
Yes, well, Section 4 would be the place to start.
I see.
Section 4 would be the place to start, and then each place where we have a defense, well, for example, in the area of justification, in Section 18 we say justification is a defense. Well, now, under case law, self-defense is now what we would characterize as a plain defense, which means that the defendant raises the issue of self-defense. And once this element is interjected into the trial, the burden is on the state to disprove that. We would continue that same allocation of the burden under our proposal. But on the other hand, in the insanity defense, we continue the same provision we have in existing law, and that is that the burden with regard to the defendant's incapacity to commit the crime because of insanity or mental disease, the defendant not only must raise that, but he also must establish that by a preponderance of the evidence. The state is not required to disprove this defense.
To fully implement the philosophy here, you have to go through each section for the different types of offenses.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments? Not? Thanks a lot, Don.
Now, Mr. Chairman, we had also on the agenda, or I was anticipating that we could get into Article 1 if you wanted to attempt to do that.
How long do you anticipate that would take?
Well, it's a fairly short article, but there are some very meaty things in it. I would like to, if I could, Mr. Chairman, if we could just get through, say, Section 2, I think that's very significant, and I don't think should prove to be controversial, but I think just as a statement of the general principles and what this Senate Bill 40 is trying to do, it might be...
All right, let's go ahead. Before we do that, I'd like to welcome the other members of the House Judiciary that have arrived. Okay.
Page 4 of the bill, Section 2 sets out the general purposes and the provisions of this act, those being A, to ensure the public safety by preventing the commission of offenses through the deterrent influence of the sentences authorized, the correction and rehabilitation of those convicted, and their confinement when required in the interests of public protection. B, to forbid and prevent conduct that unjustifiably and inexcusably inflicts or threatens substantial harm to individual or public interest. C, to give fair warning of the nature of the conduct declared to constitute an offense and of the sentences authorized upon conviction. D, to define the act or omission and the accompanying mental state that constitute each offense, and limit the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault. E, to differentiate on reasonable grounds between serious and minor offenses. F, to prescribe penalties which are proportionate to the seriousness of offenses and which permit recognition of differences in rehabilitation possibilities among individual offenders. And finally, to safeguard offenders against excessive, disproportionate, or arbitrary punishment. This statement of principles and purposes, I doubt that many people would quarrel with. However, these are not articulated in our existing law. The Commission believed that a general statement, since this is an integrated code, a general statement of the overall purposes of the code was in order. And the Commission attempted to place those under the ABC listing and somewhat in order of importance, but not necessarily. It's a little difficult to grade B and C against each other and say, well, this one should be stated before the others. But I think there was a general feeling that A, to ensure the public safety, should be placed first as the basic overall objective of this criminal code. Subsection 2 of this section, the rule that a penal statute is to be strictly construed shall not apply to this act or any of its provisions, is a restatement of existing law. And one other thing I think in there probably bears further comment, and that is that with respect to paragraph D, limit the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault, you will find as we go through the offenses that are articulated by the bill that we provided for a new non-criminal offense that we denote as a violation. Now, we've also provided for certain types of culpability that are required before a person can be guilty of a crime. And those elements, and these are the only terms that we use throughout the proposal to denote culpability, are intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and with criminal negligence. Now, in order for a person to be guilty of a crime, he would have to act with one of those degrees of culpability, either be criminally negligent or knowingly commit an act or intentionally commit an act. And not only do we set out these four types of culpability, but we define or attempt to define what we mean by them. So that as a consequence, you get away from some of the old terms that you find throughout the statutes now, terms that the courts have had extreme difficulty in trying to determine what is meant by them, terms such as maliciously and wantonly, this type of thing. These terms are not used in our code. And the relationship of these definitions for culpability and the non-criminal offense of violation is very significant because if it's a so-called strict liability offense, for example, that it would be considered as a violation, and the only penalty that could be imposed would be a fine or other civil remedy or civil penalty.
Could you give me an illustration of that now?
Yeah, sure. Well, for example, say you have a statute that says you shall not walk on the left side of the street, for example, this type of thing, without any statement as to whether or not you did it recklessly or negligently. You're just not supposed to do it. It's prohibited by statute. And so that from the standpoint of the public, as far as preventing this type of conduct, and as far as rehabilitation of an individual who has committed this kind of conduct, that individual had no intent to commit this act. He had no evil motive for doing it. He didn't knowingly do it. He just did it. The proposed code says that the code can contain this kind of offense, but if you do it, that the only penalty you can impose is a fine, that you can't lock a man up for doing something where there was no really criminal culpability in his act.
Overparking could be an example.
Whereas certainly certain kinds of crimes are the more serious ones all contain, and they do under existing law, either a general criminal intent or a specific intent to commit, not necessarily commit a specific crime, but to commit an act or a series of acts that will result in a crime.
Possession.
Right. And now we have only two such offenses in Senate Bill 40. All the rest of the offenses we've put in here are graded either as a felony of some type or a misdemeanor of some type. And they in turn then, but we also provide that the legislature, when it enacts a specific statute, say, assuming that Senate Bill 40 were enacted, and then after that time, at some future session of the legislature, obviously there are going to be other laws enacted, and the legislature can or could provide specifically for this kind of offense if it indicated clearly in the statute that it was knowingly doing this, and so you could have strict liability. But this adopts a general policy as opposed to this kind of liability on the part of the public without an element of willfulness or intent. And it also provides, however, that if you have a strict liability type of offense, that the state can plead and establish one of the kinds of culpability. In other words, if the state, in the hypothetical about overparking, for example, if the state provided or pleaded in its charge against the defendant that he, with criminal negligence, overparked, or recklessly overparked, or willfully, and could prove that, then the penalty could be then upgraded into one of the areas that carries a jail sentence. All right, Mr. Chairman, were there any other questions with respect to Section 2?
Any others? I think we should go through this and adopt this section at a time, so I'll entertain a motion. Is that will of the committee?
So moved. That'd be 1 and 2, Section 1 and 2.
Yes, it's been, Senator Carson moves that we adopt Section 1 and 2. Heard the motion, let's have a roll call.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure I know what the numbers now is. We're talking about Part 1 of General Provisions, and then we're talking about Sections 1 and 2 of Part 1. Is that right?
Right.
Of
Article 1.
Right.
Yeah.
For both sections, Section 1 and 2, roll call vote. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Cook? Senator Failey? Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Perry? Senator, Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Sections 1 and 2 have been adopted. At least we're on our way.
314 more to go.
Mr. Chairman, before we proceed, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes.
This sounds like a dirty question to some people I know, but I happen to have been a member of the American Civil Liberties Union long before most of you folks could read. And not you, yourself. But I'm wondering if there would be a devil's advocate here. Is it possible that there might be a someone from the ACLU or someone that might be possibly taking a contrary point of view? As a layman, I would appreciate that type of...
We are going to notify all interested parties, Senator Hoyt, and I think that the sections that we are dealing with today will be fairly non-controversial.
I wouldn't question that, but right. I'm sure we're going to get some things I don't know anything about, and
right.
Perfectly willing to take everybody's word for it, but I'd want to see who else's right. word, too.
And anytime you have a suggestion,
I don't have a suggestion
you want here.
Right? I would like to have them invited to have an observer here who is knowledgeable with the bill. And have them here at all our meetings if I had my druthers.
All right.
I'd like to have you request
we'll
that.
We'll try to have you have your druthers.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, you want to proceed, Don?
Pardon me?
Don't go further?
Well, if you're all up to it.
Right, let's go.
Mr. Chairman, I was just asked a question, and maybe, although it may be getting a little ahead of ourselves, about what happens if, say, in a violation, if he's sentenced to pay a fine and he doesn't pay the fine, what happens to him? Can he still be sent to jail? And so are you right back where you started? But we do have specific sections dealing in the bill. We have sections dealing with fines and costs both. And Section 81 sets forth the time and method of payments of fines and costs. And that's on page 36 of your bill. And it provides under subsection 1, when a defendant is sentenced to pay a fine or cost, the court may grant permission for payment to be made within a specified period of time or in specified installments. If no such permission is included in the sentence, the fine shall be payable forthwith. Sub 2, when a defendant sentenced to pay a fine or cost is also placed on probation or imposition or execution of sentence is suspended, the court may make payment of the fine or cost a condition of probation or suspension of sentence. Section 82, I think, really specifically answers the question about the consequences of non-payment. And it provides, when a defendant sentenced to pay a fine defaults in the payment thereof or of any installment, the court on motion of the district attorney or on its own motion may require him to show cause why his default should not be treated as contempt of court and may issue a show cause citation or a warrant of arrest for his appearance. Unless the defendant shows that his default was not attributable to his intentional refusal to obey the order of the court or to a failure on his part to make a good faith effort to make the payment, the court may find that his default constitutes contempt and may order him committed until the fine or specified part thereof is paid. When a fine is imposed on, well, that's on corporations, but then sub 4 then is a limiting clause on the general imprisonment. The term of imprisonment for contempt for non-payment of fines shall be set forth in the commitment order and shall not exceed 1 day for each $10 of the fine. It could be more, though. The court would be empowered, for example, under this, to sentence him to 1 day for every $25 or every $50, depending on how the court wanted to treat it. It would not be limited to the $5 a day that is provided for in our existing statute. And it cannot exceed 30 days if the fine was imposed upon conviction of a violation or a misdemeanor, or 1 year in any other case, whichever is a shorter period. Under 5, it provides, if it appears to the satisfaction of the court that the default in the payment of a fine is not contempt, and I think this would be particularly applicable in the case of an indigent defendant, the court may enter an order allowing the defendant additional time for payment, reducing the amount thereof or of each installment, or revoking the fine or the unpaid portion thereof in whole or in part. What we're trying to do is give the court as much flexibility here as possible. Now, I'm certainly not going to represent to this committee that there wouldn't be instances in which a defendant might be sentenced to imprisonment the same as he is now. And I suppose the argument could be made that, well, what have you gained? Well, I think the answer to that is that you've provided the court with an opportunity to deal with these individuals on a case-by-case basis so that if you have an indigent defendant, and this is not known to the court at the time, I think it's probably unlikely, or it should be unlikely, that if the court knows this defendant can't pay the fine to start with, that no fine would be imposed. But if it were imposed and the defendant didn't pay, then the court would have to give the defendant a hearing, at which time the defendant then could establish for the court the reasons for the non-payment. So I think the idea is not to completely eliminate the threat of jail as an inducement for payment of fine, but to get away from the injustice that now can result where a defendant is automatically sent to jail if he doesn't pay a fine.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask some questions about this? This is a section of the law that's given me a great deal of trouble from the first day I came to the legislature. I think that we did raise it a couple of dollars a day. And certainly, liberty is just as sweet to a poor man as it is to a rich man. And you brought out this thing very well. You have a minimum of $10 now, which certainly is an improvement. I guess my question is there any better way? Are there any states or is there any country that has devised a method where a poor man got the same value on his liberty comparatively as a rich man?
Well, think that at least all of the jurisdictions we examine provide for some method of dealing with fines. And I think it would become more significant under our proposed code than it is now, because particularly if the legislature in the future should see fit to enact more violations and fewer crimes. Because if you have a crime that, or if you have an offense that's designated as a violation, the fine is going to be the only means of enforcing that statute. And that now these proposals that we're recommending are based on the New York and Michigan approach, and somewhat the model penal code approach. I think that the only other way to ensure that you'd have absolute justice in every case would be not to provide for any fines for certain classes of individuals. But then you get into some other very, I think, legitimate questions about equal protection.
Can I pursue this just a little bit?
Equal protection of the laws and applying them uniformity to the population as a whole.
I realize that the only real protection is that you have a judge that's all wise and compassionate. Now, are there any foreign countries that are doing a better job in this area than we are? I know you're familiar with what's happening in the United States.
I can't answer that, Senator. I know that indirectly we had the benefit of the model penal codes, the American Law Institution's examination of this area, and I know that that their recommendations took into account what they found in other countries. We did not make any effort in this particular area to examine the laws of foreign countries on this.
I know that $10 isn't any more a magic number than five. I'm satisfied that it's too low. But it seemed to me that there's not many opportunities to examine this particular question except in this committee, certainly at this session. And from my 12 years, it's dang seldom that it comes up when you get a chance to get to it.